The most prominent events of the inaugural festivities this week took place on Monday, but you may not have realized the official events didn't end with those inaugural balls on Monday night. Rather, the president and vice president and much of official Washington gathered Tuesday morning at the National Cathedral for a service of music and prayer and preaching. As you've probably heard by now, the preacher in that most prominent pulpit on a very prominent day was none other than the Reverend Adam Hamilton. He's senior pastor at Church of the Resurrection in Leawood, Kansas, and a few other sites around the metro, and he is our guest this morning. Adam Hamilton, welcome to Central Standard.
Brian, it's great to be with you today. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, it was quite the honor that you received to be asked to preach at this service. When did you find out that you'd be invited to do this?
Well, it was about 3 weeks ago, and my assistant called. I was working on my sermon at home, and my assistant called and said, well, the White House just called for you and said, you know, they'd like to talk to you. And I said, come on, seriously, did they really call? No, they really did. So I called back, and they said, we'd like for you to preach for the National Prayer Service. And you know, to be honest, I wasn't really thinking clearly. I said, well, what date is it again? And he told me, so, well, let me check my calendar. And
and
I actually got my calendar.
Yourself, it doesn't really matter what my calendar
exactly.
Says,
and it's like, what are you saying? You know, if the president wants you to come preach the prayer service, you're going to be there. So anyway, it was about 3 weeks ago.
Wow. And was it a total surprise? I mean, had you had any connection to the White House or people there?
No, I really hadn't. I had met Joshua Dubois, who's in charge of the faith-based initiatives of the president. I'd met him before, but I really didn't have any connections there. I was really surprised.
So I guess I'm curious. Why do you think they asked you? I mean, what is you weren't a stranger to them completely,
right? I've asked myself that several times, and I think part of what they know is Church of the Resurrection is a church that's inclusive. It's a large congregation that has a broad reach across the United Methodist Church, but it's also inclusive and welcomes everyone and are, you know, fairly centrist. And so I think that had something to do with it. Our work in the public schools here in Kansas City probably had something to do with it. And but I'm still asking myself that question.
Yeah, well, and I think it's fair to say that the general consensus is you rose to the occasion. You decided that you'd talk about lessons from Moses as your sermon topic. How do you go about choosing a topic when you're preaching to the president?
Yeah, that was really hard. The first couple of nights, I found myself, at night, really not even sleeping, thinking, what is it that I should, that I should be preaching on? And I really spent time in prayer, just saying, God, please help me to not, not miss this opportunity. It's a profound moment. You know, please help me to hear the right thing. And I was sitting down, and I began. Suddenly, it just came to me. You know, leadership lessons from Moses. You know, there's something here. And part of what I realized is I felt like the president and and the leaders in Washington probably needed a pastoral word of encouragement and blessing. I hope that somewhere there would be something that would inspire them to help us be our very best. Something that they would find inspirational as they started their second term, and then something that would challenge, something that would really speak to where are we today in the country. And I felt like Moses' story had an opportunity to do all of those things.
Well, we want to listen to a little bit of that sermon today. This is from fairly early in the sermon when you're beginning to talk about Moses and his character and what it might have to say to our day. Let's listen to Adam Hamilton preaching on Tuesday at the inaugural prayer service.
Now, Moses' humility was coupled with a deep compassion and courageous concern for the marginalized and the oppressed. He was raised in Pharaoh's palace. He had everything a man could possibly want. But when he saw the plight of the Hebrew slaves, he could not remain in silence and he could not remain in the palace. Ultimately, he risked his life to stand before Pharaoh and to demand that Pharaoh release the slaves. And he led them into the wilderness towards the promised land. This is what God looks for in the scriptures from every king, every rabbi, every leader. He looks for those who will take seriously the call to justice, to do kindness, to speak up for those who cannot speak up for themselves. James says it this way, true religion and undefiled before God is to care for the widows and the orphans. And Jesus says at the last judgment, it all comes down to this, how did you respond to the needs of the least of these? Now, this is America at her best. At our best, we're a humble people, and we remember the call to have compassion for the least of these, which is why Emma Lazarus's magnificent poem is etched inside the Statue of Liberty with these words, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be breathed free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Humility and courageous compassion for the marginalized and the oppressed are central to the heart and character of Moses and are meant to be central to the heart and character of this nation.
That's Reverend Adam Hamilton preaching on Tuesday at the inaugural prayer service. Adam, I'm wondering, how different is it to preach to the president? How different was it to prepare a sermon with that kind of congregation?
Yeah, it was very intimidating. I was thinking to myself, you know, how do you not come across as though you're lecturing the president? You know, I haven't walked in his shoes. I don't know what it feels like to bear the whole burdens of this country. And so not to stand as though you're lecturing, to make sure that you offer something, though, that isn't just fluff. I think it could be very easy to go in and offer a word that was just very superficial. And so it was a challenge. And I the sermon came fairly quickly. I really felt inspired. I felt like I had an important word. But I got to tell you, I practiced it 20 times, you know, over and over again, just trying to make sure, okay, is this right? I spent time with some other pastors here in Kansas City and said, tell me what you think about this. Does this seem like it says the right thing? I invited my congregation to be praying for me, and I really felt that. You know, as I started to walk into the pulpit at the National Cathedral is this amazing, you know, this beautiful pulpit, and you walk up about 8 stairs to get to it. And what struck me as I was walking up was this was the pulpit where Dr. King preached his last Sunday morning sermon, was from this pulpit. And there have been other, you know, and it was Martin Luther King weekend, and here I'm preaching to the first African-American president, and it was just the whole experience was humbling and also, you know, daunting. But when I stepped in the pulpit, and on the way, I kept thinking all the things that could go wrong. You know, I thought, okay, I'm going to trip as I go up these stairs. I'm going to spill the water all over everywhere. My notes are going to fall off the pulpit, and my throat started to tighten as I'm stepping up there. But when I stepped in the pulpit, I just felt this assurance and this sense of strength and inspiration. And I had about 1,500 of our resurrection members in our sanctuary praying for me during that time that God would use me somehow to bless and speak a timely word. And I felt their prayers. And it was just, it was awesome, really.
I understand you even were streaming the service for members of your congregation back here in.
Yeah, that's right. There were 1,500 of them gathered in the sanctuary, and they were watching and worshiping, and it was I got great response from them as well.
Pastors, I think in my experience are actually usually very careful not to address any one person with their issues in their sermon. You don't want to make a sermon about one person, but in this case, it's sort of hard not to.
Yeah, it really was. I tried to make sure that the sermon itself would speak to everyone. You know, both those in the room who were political leaders but to anybody who would listen, that there'd be something in there for them. And I tried to look around the room during the message, but it was really clear that everyone was gathered there to be with the president during that worship service. And so the president's on the front row along with Michelle Obama, and then the vice president and his wife, Dr. Biden, and then the cabinet members back behind them. And so you realize this is a moment really where you can speak to the president on behalf of everyone else in the room and in the process really speak to them as well.
We have another part of the sermon here where you are very directly addressing the president. Let's take a listen to that.
Proverbs notes this: without a vision, the people perish. They don't literally perish. They just bicker and fight and become so polarized they can't get anything done. We're in need of a new common national vision, not one that is solely Democratic or solely Republican. We need at least one or two goals or dreams that Americans on both sides of the aisle can come together and say, yes, that's what it means to be American. That's where we need to go. God has given you a unique gift, Mr. President. Unlike any other president we've ever had, you have the ability to cast vision and inspire people. You should have been a preacher.
And that particular line got quite a lot of reporting afterward in the press.
Yes. And it was fun to, you know, in that moment leading up to that, I felt like I was stepping on the edge of the line there to, you know, not, you know, I talked before that about the fact that so often the vision casting that's done by the political parties feels more like election year rhetoric to us. We have two competing visions and that we're really polarized as a country and everybody feels it, but it was sort of the elephant in the room. And so just to name that, I felt like, okay, you're really stepping on thin ice here in this moment, but I think it needs to be said. And then if I can come back and affirm the president and affirm his gifts And part of, even at the inauguration, you know, he cast a lofty vision of equality and justice for everyone. And he laid out, you know, probably 8 visions in that. And most leaders know you can lay out maybe 1 or 2 visions and you can accomplish that. But the real challenge is today, as Americans, we only come together when there's a crisis. When there's a Katrina or there's a 9/11, we come together for a little while and then we go back to our corners. And when the president lays out a vision himself, immediately the Republicans react. Or if it's a Republican administration, the Democrats react. And it seems to me that if you could get, before the president would lay out a vision, if he could bring together both Republicans and Democrats and say, hey, let's figure this out together. Let's come up with 1 or 2 things that we can stack hands on and say, we think this matters and we're gonna drive together in this. And I think Americans would unite behind that. And you know, we can still disagree about 100 other things, but somehow finding this common, you know, the common good that we can all agree upon seems to me like maybe one strategy for uniting us.
I wonder, did you get to spend any time with the president and first lady apart from these 12 minutes?
Yeah, a little bit just before the service, and they were very gracious. There were the two of them, as well as Vice President Biden and Dr. Biden, were together, and they were having pictures with each of, you know, had pictures made for each of us who were participating. And you know, the president said, he said, well, you know, it must be pretty daunting having to preach in front of all these other preachers who are here today. I said, yeah, that's the thing that I'm really daunted by. Yeah. I said, no, you know, what really scares me is thinking I'm having to preach before your wife and Dr. Biden, because I know who the power brokers are in these relationships. And they all laughed and just were very, very gracious. It was very humble in their approach to everybody in the back room.
Did you get to take on other activities in the inaugural weekend?
Yeah, we were there on, of course, for the inauguration. We were there for the inaugural parade. And then that evening at the inaugural ball, too. And all of that was just it doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. It's something really special that happens when you see how we as Americans transition power and then to celebrate it. It was really quite remarkable.
You know, it's sort of an interesting thing that in a country with a clear separation of church and state, where we have no state religion, where we have no religious obligations, that this worship service, and a pretty explicitly Christian worship service, would be part of part of the weekend celebrations. In fact, I think we have a caller with a question about that. This is Hawkeye in Overland Park. Good morning.
Pastor Hamilton. I'm one of the organizers of local free-thinking groups here in Kansas City. And my question for you is, you know, in light of the all-inclusive message that Obama has expressed in his inauguration address, in the first, you know, during the first inauguration, he actually explicitly mentioned non-believers in the first address. And the second address, my understanding was he didn't. Did your sermon actually include any role for non-believers here in America, which are about 20%, which are what you would call nuns, atheists, agnostics, or people who are completely irreligious or don't care about religion? Did you address that? Did the president ever address that? Or where do you see the role of interaction of non-believers in this country who are growing in numbers, and especially the younger generation? I'm sure that you're aware of the statistics.
Good question. Thanks, Hawkeye. Adam Hamilton?
You. Sure. Yeah, thank you, Hawkeye. My hope was the sermon that I preached would have spoken to leaders regardless of, you know, whether they had any religious affiliation at all or not. The idea of being humble and being concerned for the marginalized, the idea of casting vision and how important vision is, and the importance of never giving up in the face of adversity. And so I intentionally was thinking about a message that would speak across lines, across religions, and even to non-religious people. And clearly all of us are Americans. This is our country together. And so while I'm a Christian and I, you know, I hope to reach out to as many non-religious people as possible. In fact, we started our church for thinking people who were non-religious or nominally religious. We're Americans together, and I think we all play a role in this. And I think I would preach my message to, you know, that same message to a group of atheists and say, listen, we need to be humble and courageous and care about the poor and marginalized, and we need to have a common vision. And we need to find a way of not giving up when we face adversity.
What do you think is the place of this sort of service, this sort of ritual in the context of a pluralistic nation like ours?
Right. Well, as I understand it, George Washington called for this first service, and he wanted to start the first day of his first term by being in worship and by saying, you know, I'm calling upon God to be of help and strength for me. And I think many of our presidents are people of faith, and it's appropriate, it seems to me, for them to acknowledge that in the beginning of their of their term. I also think it brings people of faith together. So we had a variety of participants in the service. There were Sikhs and there were Muslims and Jews and you know, all together sort of, I think it was an attempt to try to bring together the 80% who are people of faith to say, you know, I need your help too, and I need your prayers, and I need your encouragement. So I don't think it was meant to be a slap in the face of the 20%. I think it was meant to say, but for the 80%, I need you, and I need you to call upon God in the way that you do to help me to be the best leader I can be.
In addition to the variety of faiths that were represented, there was also a lot of attention paid in the planning of the service to diversity. So the service actually opened in Spanish, for example.
Right.
The Spanish was translated into English. The head of the largest sort of explicitly gay denomination was given a liturgical role in the service.
Right.
What do you think that said about the plans of this president and also the state of religion in America?
Sure. Well, I think it was certainly consistent with what the president said in his inaugural address, and that was, you know, looking at how are we bringing people together and being concerned for minority populations, for you know, for the rights of everyone. And so I think they were very clear about that. And at the same time, you know, the president is a Christian, the vice president is a Christian, they claim a Christian faith, and so, you know, the scriptures were largely drawn from the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. The hymns were largely drawn from the Christian tradition. But afterwards, I spoke with the leaders of the Sikh community who were there, and they were so excited to be invited and felt like they were, you know, it was the first time they'd ever been invited to be a part of anything like this. And the Jewish community as well, and the Muslims were, you know, I had such a wonderful, you know, gracious words of encouragement and thanks from the Muslim community who was there. And so I feel like, you know, this really was the president's way of saying, look, I'm a Christian, and I want the service to have a Christian bent. But at the same time, I want it to be welcome and affirming for other faiths as well.
I want to listen to just one more piece of the sermon, and that's actually the end of the sermon, as you sort of brought it home and tried to draw on these different threads of scripture and tradition and deliver a final message to the president.
I'd end with this story. During Dr. Martin Luther King weekend several years ago, I was listening to NPR, and they were conducting an interview with Reverend Billy Kiles, who many of you know was with Dr. King when he died on the balcony of Lorraine Motel. The interviewer asked Kiles what he'd be preaching on that weekend, and Reverend Kiles told a story you've undoubtedly heard before, but bears repeating today. He said, "I'll be telling the old story about Robert Louis Stevenson." Stevenson, the 19th century author, once told how as a boy he'd been sitting in front of the window at nightfall watching the lamplighter light the gas street lamps. He would erect a ladder at one post, and he would climb up, and he would light the lamp with a torch, and then he'd take it down and go to the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And his father walked in the room, and he said, "Son, what are you looking at the window? What do you see out there that's so fascinating?" And the young Stevenson said, "Daddy, I'm watching that man out there knock holes in the darkness." There's a lot of darkness in our world. Lead us to be a compassionate people, to be concerned for the marginalized. Help us rediscover a vision for America that is so compelling that it unites us and calls us to realize the full potential of this country to be a shining city upon a hill. And when you feel your lowest, don't give up. Wait upon the Lord. He will renew your strength, that you might lead us as a nation to knock holes in the darkness. Amen.
We got an email from Karen, who is writing to us actually from San Diego. She's listening to the program online, I guess. "I am a pastor of one of the smallest, a neighborhood church of about 100 in San Diego. I found Reverend Hamilton's sermon to be visionary for the country and the next 4 years, and also for any church of any size. How do we cast a vision that we can follow together?" she asks.
Huh. That's terrific, Karen. Thank you for those words. And I do think part of it is finding where is the common ground. You know, what is that place that we can all say, yes, this describes America at its best. And in local congregations, it's important to find, you know, I think for local churches, I say, what's your core mission? What is the purpose of the church? And then out of that purpose and looking to the scriptures, we find, well, what would that look like to live that out in our community over the next 3 years or 5 years? And at Church of the Resurrection, for us, part of that was addressing the root causes of poverty in Kansas City and looking at children at the public schools who are in poverty. And so for us, you know, we found that common vision in addressing poverty here in Kansas City as followers of Jesus Christ. And I would say, Karen, your community, undoubtedly, there are needs there that your church has an opportunity to meet, to be the incarnation of Christ in that community. And when you find that, when your people find that and you lead them in it, it's energizing and exciting and life-giving for the church and for the community.
You actually got a chance to talk a little bit about your congregation, the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection in Leawood, in the sermon, which I guess is a perk of getting to do this. I'm curious what the congregation's reaction to your getting this opportunity has been.
They have been, at least all that I've heard from so far, I received probably 600 emails that day.
Wow.
And Facebook messages, and they were so excited. And my hope was that they would feel affirmed and that it wouldn't be about me, but they would feel like, hey, this is us, you know, and you know, our pastor had a chance to speak a word to the president, and that they would feel affirmed. And telling the story of what our folks have done for the Kansas City area schools, I think they felt like, not prideful, not like, wow, look how great we are, but instead, we had a chance to be an illustration of something that could touch hundreds of other communities across the United States. And I think I hope that they're really proud of, you know, in the best possible way, of their church and of the opportunity we had together.
Your church is the largest congregation in the United Methodist Church, certainly one of the largest in the country. You've now preached to the president and vice president at their inauguration. What's next for you, Adam?
I have no idea. I think it certainly that opens up opportunities there. You know, immediately after that, PBS NewsHour asked me to be on a program. There are things like that happen. But I go back to my day job now, and I'm preaching this weekend on the seven deadly sins and how we struggle, you know, internally with temptation. I told Levon, it's pretty hard to imagine anything that tops that in terms of this profound experience. So I really don't know. I just every day I wake up and say, God, here I am. Do with me whatever you want. And I feel like I'm along for the ride.
That's the Reverend Adam Hamilton. He is senior pastor at the Church of the Resurrection in Leawood, Kansas, with some satellite campuses around town. Adam, congratulations on the honor, and thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Brian. Week.